from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, we begin an ongoing series on immigration and citizenship with focus on migration patterns in this hour. Who migrates and why, and what challenges do they face, and what are the challenges to the countries they migrate to and the countries they leave behind? Forum is next with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. This morning, we begin an ongoing series on immigration and citizenship, and we're going to focus this morning on migration patterns, patterns of migration past and present, the questions of who emigrates and why and where do they go, and the challenges to the host countries and the countries left behind. But I want to mention that on May 31st, we'll be talking about assimilation versus multiculturalism. Should immigrants be encouraged or even required to assimilate? And then on the 28th of June, we'll have a remote, a live broadcast talking about citizenship. And in fact, we want to give out a website right away because we're going to have discussions, ongoing discussions, in a discussion board on immigration and on rewriting the U.S. citizenship test. And you can simply go to www.kqed.org/immigration. I'll give that out again at the end of the hour. This hour, as I said, is going to be all about migration. People leave their host countries for a range of reasons. Most of them have to do with the desire for a better life or to escape from danger or simply to reunify with the family that they have somehow become disjointed from. Migration patterns have changed dramatically over the years and are different in different geographical regions in the world. We want to key in on some of the history this hour and the principal issues pertaining to migration. And let me tell you who is joining us. We want to welcome, first of all, Mark Miller, who is Emma Smith Morris Professor of Political Science and International Relations at University of Delaware and joins us from the university. Good morning.
Good morning.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have with us Michael Coker, who is Deputy Vice President of the International Rescue Committee. Welcome, Michael Coker.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning to you. And I also want to welcome Kathleen Newland, who is Director of Migration and Development and Refugee Protection with the Migration Policy Institute in Washington. Welcome, Kathleen Newland.
Nice to be with you.
Good to have you with us. And let me begin, if I may, Kathleen Newland, with you and say by way of introduction to listeners that the Migration Policy Institute is one of these Just the Facts, Ma'am organizations. They are looking at science-based policy, and they're following trends, particularly in Europe and in North America. But I'd like to get kind of a historical view from you. In the 20s, 30s, and 40s, pretty low on migration, then a tremendous pickup in the 60s because the widening of the availability of migration.
That's right. Well, after World War II, it still took quite a while for economic activity to really pick up in most of the countries that had been involved. But by the 1960s, there was a tremendous demand for labor. And at the same time, the United States in 1965 changed its criteria for immigration and really opened it up beyond the traditional countries of immigration, which were mostly European, and opened it to the rest of the world. So not only did we have a big increase in migration because of the domestic demand for labor, but we also had a tremendous growth in the diversity of immigration streams coming here from literally all over the world.
And really, before World War II, there was also a different view because of what you've just stated is after World War II, migration coming from all over. And in other words, it really wasn't until after World War II that migration was looked at as a burden or an onus or a real cost and expense, wasn't it?
Well after World War II. In fact, I would say that's a pretty recent phenomenon in this country, a phenomenon of the 80s and the 90s. And it relates very much to the state of the U.S. economy in different regions of the country. I think it's no coincidence that we saw some of the first sort of anti-immigrant organized movements begin in California, where the collapse of the defense industry and a considerable regional recession started the trend of sort of questioning the need for immigrants and questioning the costs associated with having immigrants in our midst.
A lot of the debate now seems to center around remittances, and we'll talk about those.
It's an interesting story, yes.
Yeah, as opposed to the brain drain. I mean, that's we come down on the fact that remittances, that is money that goes back to the host country, here from the United States to Mexico, enormous amount of money, but the biggest ones actually are China, India, and the Philippines. There's that debate, and that's an ongoing debate, and it's really, again, a kind of post-World War II phenomenon, no?
That's right. Well, probably the biggest determinant of remittance flows is, not surprisingly, the number of migrants. And the latest estimates from the World Bank are that last year, migrants from developing countries sent home over $200 billion. Now, that's a huge sum, and it's larger than the total of worldwide foreign aid by a margin of 3 or 4. And
actually, in the international economy, it's second only to oil in terms of revenue.
That's right. It's bigger than foreign direct investment. It brings more money to Sri Lanka than the tea industry, more money to almost any country than tourism. It's the big earner for many developing countries. There are 22 countries where migrants' remittances account for more than 10% of the entire gross domestic product.
But of course, the brain drain is the consequence of that, too. People come to different countries and they leave their own countries and they can't do what they could do otherwise in their countries or host countries.
Yes, that's right. There's a lot of rethinking of the impact of the brain drain these days. There's no question that a lot of countries, particularly small countries like the countries of the Caribbean, lose a tremendous proportion of their college-educated or graduate-educated people. But there is now a lot of interest not only in what those migrants send back by way of remittances, but also the fact that they form a sort of living link for those small marginal economies with the global economy, and in some cases have brought to their countries of origin trade ties, business ties, the interest of other institutions from the developed world that have been a tremendous benefit to those countries. I mean, I suppose the example familiar to most people is the Indian software industry, which got a tremendous kickstart, may never have developed without the involvement of Indian immigrants in Silicon Valley.
Kathleen Newland, again with us from Washington, is Director of Migration and Development and Refugee Protection with the Migration Policy Institute. Michael Coker is Deputy Vice President of the International Rescue Committee. He's with us this morning from New York. And Mr. Coker, we've seen more internal displacement since World War II, and particularly, well, Vietnam in the 70s and Bosnia and Afghanistan in the 90s. And this is really your territory. It continues to increase when we look at Sudan and when we look at Colombia and, of course, when we look at Iraq. It's gotten to the point where migration patterns have a great deal to do, in fact, are contingent in many respects on displacements.
Well, absolutely right. And I think that brings up a very critical distinction. When we talk about migrants, I think we have to break out of that group refugees and internally displaced. Often, I think it's common to think of migrants and, you know, as you sort of set it up earlier, seeking a better life, economic opportunities, and so on, very critical. But our agency, the International Rescue Committee, and others like us work primarily in conflict-affected areas with refugees. This is a separate distinction under international law, the 1951 Geneva Convention, and obviously those that have to flee within their own countries. And this is very much a growing problem. Refugees and internally displaced combined, close to 30 million people now. And you touched upon the country's worst hit, Sudan, certainly, Colombia, absolutely, DR Congo, Uganda, and now increasingly a quiet crisis that's growing, Iraqi refugees having fled to Jordan and Syria, for example.
Let's talk about those Iraqi refugees, about a couple million really displaced. And at first, Jordan and Syria were somewhat amenable, but then things began to be, well, totally out of hand from their perspective. And at this point, they're pretty much ready to close down the borders, aren't they?
Well, I think you have to answer that in a couple of parts. There has been massive movement out of Iraq, up to 2 million people, with at least 1.5 or 1.7 million of those in Jordan and Syria. Jordan's a small country, not quite 6 million people total, 15% unemployment. And now about 12% of their whole population are Iraqi refugees. So I think Jordan and Syria have been very, very generous thus far in receiving Iraqi refugees. Obviously, that puts strains on host countries. They have been generous today, but the welcome is wearing thin. There's inflation in those countries. The price of rent has gone up. The price of goods in the market has gone up. There's overcrowding. And I think it's incumbent upon other governments to look to assist those host companies and also seek solutions for those that have had to flee.
That's what you really are, in effect, lobbying for. That is assistance to the host governments. And since most won't wind up resettling, you would like to have a larger resettlement program as part of what the United States is moving toward here.
Well, I think there has to be a multifaceted addressing of this broader problem because the numbers are staggering. I do think that the U.S. needs to step up. There has been some growing concern and awareness and response to this in Washington, D.C. We took a paltry number, a disgraceful number over the last few years, as few as a few hundred until recently. The U.S. has committed to taking 7,000 Iraqi refugees in the current year. There's been talk that we could take up to 20,000, maybe 25,000. That's a good start. We feel that it's still falling short. There is precedent to take refugees. You mentioned Vietnam, Afghanistan, Bosnia, certainly. And I think the U.S. and European countries as well can do much more to assist those, especially most vulnerable cases, women with children, for example, that for many of whom resettlement is the best and only option.
Talking to Michael Coker, who's Deputy Vice President of the International Rescue Committee, the Vietnamese refugees who came here, of course, came in fairly sizable numbers, and now there's talk about taking Iraqis who have been displaced. Aside from the women, the children, the elderly, I mean, there are some real security concerns.
No, there absolutely are security concerns. We shouldn't shirk that as an issue. But there are processes in place to address this. There's a screening process, Department of Homeland Security, and so on. Our concern is that these security screening processes have gone too far to the point of being almost unreasonable. These issues can be addressed and must be addressed in the process, but it should not categorically be a block to people coming here in responsible numbers.
How can you screen someone who might be, say, a potential suicide bomber? What means can a young person coming here?
I'm not sure. You know, when you phrase the question that way, it's difficult. I think there are screening processes where you do background checks. You can do reference checks. There have been many that have had ties to the U.S. military, for example, in Iraq that have had to flee because of those ties. They have already gone through internal security checks in Iraq to clear them for employment. You have relatives in the United States for many of these people. Many women with kids that have fled Iraq, for example, have relatives. There have been Iraqis in this country for a long time in communities like Detroit or L.A. or Dallas. There are mechanisms and information where you can do responsible screening to mitigate the issue you address.
And again, Michael Coker is the Deputy Vice President of the International Rescue Committee. Mark Miller is Emma Smith Morris Professor of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Delaware, also the author of The Age of Immigration, International Population Movements in, of Migration, International Population Movements in the Modern World is a subtitle. And Professor Miller, this is the age of migration that we're in right now, isn't it?
Well, my co-author Stephen Castles and I make that argument in the book, but it's important to point out that there's always been a great deal of migration in international history. And if we go back to the period that you were talking about with my friend Kathleen Newland from MPI, I would just add in an observation that anti-immigrantism really doesn't begin in California after World War II. We need to recall that Americans historically have been ambivalent about migration. We celebrate it, but we we also have opposed it.
Well, the xenophobia just here in San Francisco with the Chinese, for example.
That's precisely what I was going to recall, that there was violence against the Chinese, and we have to remember that Asians couldn't become citizens of the United States until as late as 1952. It's just extraordinary when you think about that.
But we have seen these changes. I mean, there's been a kind of feminization of migration, increasing globalization, and politicization of migration. I mean, all of those have sort of come under scrutiny, and you have given us a good deal of information along those lines with your co-author. But what we haven't seen is really the regulatory aspect of this. I mean, how do you regulate international migration, or can you regulate international migration?
Yeah, I think it's the largest area of the international political economy that where we've failed to establish a regime between the various states. Now, we have a partial regime. We have a refugee regime, and there's regional agreements such as the EU and whatnot, but thus far, a global migration regime has proved elusive, and that's why migration is oftentimes viewed as a major challenge, not only to domestic politics, but to foreign policy as well, by countries all around the world.
Talking to Mark Miller again, who's co-author of The Age of Migration, and Emma Smith Morris, Professor of Political Science and International Relations at University of Delaware. If we subscribe to the Geneva Convention, we'd have to return a lot of these migrants, wouldn't we?
Well, under the Geneva Convention, you cannot return refugees to situations of endangerment. That's called non-refoulement. And that particular provision in Europe is seen as very burdensome, and we've seen dramatic changes in European attitudes towards refugees, and it's really quite worrisome. I don't know if they would, many governments would sign the Geneva Convention if they could opt out.
What about countries, though, that are not deemed or thought to be dangerous for the return of refugees under the Geneva Accord or under the Geneva Convention, excuse me?
Well, for example, if you had an applicant who was not found to be eligible for refugee status in your country, then you would have to have some kind of agreement for this person to go to another country, and oftentimes that's hard to procure. Okay.
Understood. And we don't really have a great path, I know, as you see it, to legalization, and we haven't had an integration policy. Well, we had one in the 20s, but it's been sort of laissez-faire from the 50s and 60s. Canada is much more productive, for example, in making immigrant citizens than we are. What are they doing that we're not doing or should be doing?
Well, Canada is a fascinating case. There, they take in about 1% of the total population, which is about 30 million each year, and there's a broad political consensus in support of a legal immigration policy. And they offer more extensive services to migrants. They have what is called in the language of migration students, immigrants' policies to help with the integration. But I would defer, of course, to Kathleen in this area. That's more her area of expertise than mine.
Well, Kathleen Newland, we are seeing increased ethnic diversity from migration and more multicultural societies like we identify with many of the cities in Canada particularly, aren't we?
Yes, there has, since 1965, been this tremendous diversification of our immigrant stream. And whereas most of the immigrants in the U.S. used to come from Europe, and, you know, we see that in the communities of Irish origin, Polish origin, Scandinavians, all, you know, classic nation of immigrant stuff. But now our largest immigrant groups are from Mexico, from China, from India, from the Philippines, Vietnam. So it's a different composition, and it's a group of people with different needs. I think when you look at what's actually happening with immigrant integration, it's pretty much what's always happened in the U.S. That is that, you know, people come, they congregate in ethnic enclaves. Very often the first generation, particularly the elderly among them, don't learn to speak English, and they sort of cling to the community of their sort of co-nationals. But over time, you know, in the second generation, everybody speaks English. In the third generation, people have forgotten their mother tongue or their grandmother tongue, I guess it would be in that case. The United States really is a language graveyard in that sense. So people do integrate, but it takes time. And I think there is a great deal more that we could do in terms of public policy to ease that process and to speed it along, particularly in the provision of language instruction and the more sort of hands-on introduction to American ways and norms and, you know, how do you negotiate the legal system? What do you do if you get a parking ticket? Just very basic things that immigrants don't know when they come here. And they probably could learn faster if they had more help from the society they've becoming a part of.
Yeah, I think, Mark Miller, you're in accord with that, aren't you?
Yeah, I point out that back in the 19th century, we actually did much more to encourage immigrant integration into the United States. For example, back in the 19th century, after 2 years of stay in the United States, you could sign a form and you would then be known as an intending citizen. And so very often states back then would allow intending citizens to vote in municipal and state elections. And that status also made them eligible for, say, the homestead grants to buy properties under the Homestead Act. There were much more active programs at the state level, in particular, to encourage integration and incorporation of immigrants. And maybe we should think more about going back to that past practice.
On the other hand, you seem to feel that the green card system here works a lot better as far as a temporary worker policy than what we see in other industrialized countries.
Yes. I've been studying migration for 30 years, and but it dawned on me very early on that the legal immigration system, of what we call commonly our green card system, is preferable as a public policy over, say, seasonal foreign worker policies or guest worker style policies, because in the United States we admit legal permanent aliens with virtually all the rights of citizens, and it's not problematic in any way for them to achieve citizenship, to undergo naturalization in our society. And so I would say that if there is a perceived need to admit aliens for economic reasons, bring them in with the most rights possible. The problems of guest worker and seasonal worker policies are the contingency and the less rights that seem to be inherent in such admission systems.
We're coming up on a break here, and I want to give out our phone number for those of you who would like to join us in this whole subject of migration as we begin our immigration series. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, you're invited to join us. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or send us an email. The email address here is forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We begin today a three-part series on immigration. On May 31st, we'll be talking about assimilation versus multiculturalism, and on June 28th, we'll be at San Francisco City Hall talking about requirements of good citizenship. Today, It's looking at migration and migration patterns and why people leave their host countries and what it means to the host countries as well as to the countries that they go to. We have a panel that includes Mark Miller, Emma Smith-Morris, Professor of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Delaware, Michael Coker, Deputy Vice President of International Rescue Committee, and Kathleen Newland, Director of Migration and Development and Refugee Protection with the Migration Policy Institute. Reminder also that we have a discussion board on rewriting U.S. citizenship, and you are also invited to participate in that simply by going to the website, www.kqed.org/immigration. And I wanted to also remind listeners that today there will be a free panel discussion all about the economic impact of immigration on our communities. It's a co-sponsored event being done by De Anza College and KQED, presenting a forum again this afternoon at De Anza College from 3:30 p.m. until 6:30 p.m. And if you'd care to join us, you're certainly welcome to do so by calling in at our toll-free number, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. It's toll-free for your calls, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. And before I begin taking calls and emails, I just wanted to go back to Kathleen Newland of the Migration Policy Institute to get a sense of some of the patterns. Certainly, earlier on, we were seeing, as you mentioned, Kathleen Newland, a lot of Europeans coming here. Now, most of the migration patterns in the Americas go from south to north. What about some of the other global patterns that we're seeing?
Well, I think other countries are seeing much the same diversification of their immigration streams from old source countries to new ones. I mean, for example, if you look back into the 1950s, most of the immigration in Western Europe was coming from Southern Europe to Northern Europe, so Spain, Greece, Portugal, and of course Ireland, which isn't Southern Europe, but was also a country of emigration at a very substantial level. All of these countries are now countries of immigration. Rather than sending people out, they're now seeing people from all over the world wanting to come and join their society and their labor market. So these transitions in immigration patterns are part of human history and always have been. From the United States are, I think almost any country of immigration, proximity is a big factor. So in the United States, our largest immigrant group is Mexicans. In Europe, their largest immigrant groups are from North Africa and from Eastern Europe. In Australia, they get their immigrants from Asia. Again, there's great diversity, but the biggest groups in any country of immigration tend to come from neighboring countries. So neighborhood makes a big difference.
And we'll go into our neighborhood of callers here and get as many of you on as we can in the hour. Ellen, you're first. Good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Good morning. Thank you. And thank you for the series. I just wanted to comment on the Iraqi situation. I was the former director of the U.S. refugee program in Saudi Arabia. And I think that we have a moral obligation, given our role in the current Iraqi refugee crisis, to consider taking significant numbers of those refugees.
What about the moral obligation, as the caller describes it, Michael Coker?
Well, I would agree with her. I think, again, people fleeing Iraq are doing so as a direct result of violence. They have had family members kidnapped or killed. They've been expelled from their neighborhoods and their homes. Death threats, rapes, intimidation, extortion. I just spent a couple of weeks in Jordan and Syria and met with a number of families, Iraqi, that they simply can't go back. They did not choose to leave for economic opportunity. They left because they were in direct danger. And the prospects for them going home in the near, even midterm, and frankly long-term, are very, very slight. I agree with the caller. The U.S. should do more.
And I thank the caller, and we'll go to more of your calls. We'll go to Andres next. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to reference when the previous speaker was talking about looking back at 19th century practices to encourage immigrants to stay here and become citizens in this country. And while I encourage that, I think it's also important to be explicit that at that time there were laws in this country that legally excluded Chinese immigrants, and that some of these advantages that were given to immigrants who were allowed to come in, like homesteading, ended up displacing not only Native Americans but also Mexicans who had been here previously, so that when we take a look back at 19th century practices, we should also be looking at it in context to make sure that we're taking a true look at the history.
Okay. Mark Miller, you want to comment on the caller?
Oh, I agree totally. These are very fine observations. We have to remember that immigration policy to the United States really up until 1965 was for white Europeans. And we even treated some of those who we would regard as white Europeans with racial bias. That was inherent in the Quota Acts of 1921-24 that subsisted until 1965. I'm thinking of the national origins visa selection process. No, you're quite right. Even back in the colonial era, we kind of looked at expansion as a God-given right for white Europeans, the new Americans. And I totally concur with the caller's concern that we keep in mind the violence that was done to indigenous peoples here in North America as a result.
And let me thank the caller, Andres, and go to one of the emails that sort of dovetails. This is from Kurt, one of our listeners, who says, when you talk about patterns of U.S. immigration, it should be noted that current immigration rates into the United States had never been higher. The current volume of people settling here even surpasses the great waves at the turn of the 19th to 20th centuries. When things reach an extreme, be it the stock market, the housing market, the planet temperature, the snowpack, the sea level, etc., it's always a cause for concern, need I say alarm. Are we in an immigration bubble which is unsustainable and about to burst? Please discuss. Mark Miller.
Well, as I said, historically, Americans have been ambivalent about migration, and that extends way back into the 19th century. Just think of the Irish, for example. They were hardly met with open arms and embraces. But Kathleen was right about the intergenerational pattern of integration and incorporation in the United States. Now, the caller is right that we are experiencing a period of massive migration. I would not call it unprecedented, but it is very, very substantial. And it's a legitimate question to ask, will the historic pattern of integration and incorporation continue? I tend to be more optimistic than pessimistic about that. But I think it's a very legitimate question to ask, and I think it's something that Americans ought to discuss very carefully.
You share Professor Miller's optimism, Kathleen Newlin?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think there's nothing to indicate that we have a long-term problem of immigrants not integrating over time, despite of some of the things you hear about people not wanting to learn English and so on. There's just really no hard evidence for that. I think where it comes from is that though we are not in a period where immigration is historically high as a percentage of the population of our population, it is historically high in absolute numbers, and it's also relatively concentrated, although less so than it has been, but it's relatively concentrated in certain parts of the country, on the West Coast, on the Eastern Seaboard, and in Florida, although it is spreading out all over the United States. There are a lot of communities that are seeing immigrants now who really have not experienced immigration for over 100 years. So it does have it shakes things up. And I think it's not surprising that people react to that, that some people react to that with alarm. But I, especially when I contrast the immigration experience in this country with that in Europe, where they have much more profound problems of integration having to do with fundamental identity, what I think in the United States, we have a sense of what it means to be an American, that you buy into a certain set of values and principles and a certain way of life, which, you know, includes individualism and includes bootstraps and all of that, whereas in Europe, people rely much more heavily on the state, and identity is something that is not really as consciously constructed as it is here. It's something that tends to be more rooted in really long-term history, and so it's more difficult to alter it. But I think we have every reason in this country to be optimistic about the future of newcomers in America, and I think it's one of the causes of the dynamism of this country compared to most other countries that don't embrace immigration.
Kathleen Newland again. And by the way, it's amazing to me that you direct migration and your name is Kathleen Newland.
isn't that nice? And even more amazing, perhaps, that I'm an 11th generation American. You know, but it's an old Welsh name.
Migration Policy Institute. Well, notwithstanding the optimism we just heard from you and Professor Miller, let me just read another email here from a listener named Craig who says, earlier this month, a report from Columbia University predicted that within the next 15 years, most of Mexico and Central America, due to global warming, will experience permanent drought. When these people's lands become uninhabitable, how is the USA planning to deal with 100 million or so environmental refugees? Will the U.S. erase the borders between Mexico and Central America and become the borderless EU of the Americas? Well, I don't know if anybody here has the crystal ball or can be a soothsayer, but to a great extent, the question raises another central question, which is that we don't know the kind of stress that can lead to migration patterns, and there is a great deal of unpredictability even when we want to be optimistic.
Well, I think there's there is a very good reason to be concerned about the impact of global warming on and climate change on the potential for displacement. You know, we're already beginning to see some impact of that in more prolonged droughts, more severe storms, more flooding, that sort of thing. And in fact, I've just been the past few days at a Red Cross conference in Norway, where they were looking at trying to look at the future humanitarian needs associated with climate change from this kind of disruption of people's livelihoods, and it is a major concern. We don't like to use the word "we" in the sort of refugee business, and I'm sure Michael Coker will concur in this. We don't like to use the term environmental refugees because a refugee is somebody whose own government is not willing or able to help that person. I think countries that are affected by climate change, by severe events associated with climate change, will be in a great deal of need of help from other countries, but I don't think the first response will be to, you know, sort of want to offload their people. I think they will be looking to the rest of the world to help them make the adjustments and meet the needs of people.
It sounds like it conforms with your view of things, Michael Coker.
Yeah, I think Kathleen's absolutely right. I think that environment is going to be a growing concern for population movements and will cause displacement and refugee movements, as my organization, the International Refugee Committee, would think of it. I mean, look at sub-Saharan Africa now, Somalia, Ethiopia, Sudan, already drought-stricken countries. This is simply going to get worse, unfortunately, in the near term. The solution is best addressed locally. Kathleen's right. You know, these countries do not want to see their people leave, want to try to keep them. The assistance has to come locally, you know, things like irrigation, crop rotation. I could get into the weeds on this details and won't. But the G8, the industrial world, the North, as you put it earlier, needs to take a good look at this now and not later. It's going to be too late if we look at this in 20, 25 years.
Michael Coker, again, is Deputy Vice President of the International Rescue Committee. And our next caller is Mark. Good morning, Mark. You're on forum.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. There's a whole thing. You mentioned earlier the Indian support for building the economy in India. That applies everywhere. And if we use the Internet to coordinate here and use project management systems, and we use the digital earth kind of approach to pump, routing the best solutions to the places where they're needed, like biointensive gardening to save water by a factor of 5 over conventional agriculture, we can actually start a movement of people of stopping the economic breakdown and reversing it so that we might modify this immigration problem, the immigration as a problem, and start turning it into, okay, people go out, they learn, they collaborate, they go back and fix the homeland. And I think that if you could put it, let's put out the word, the International Society Symposium for Digital Earth, the fifth one is happening in Berkeley, June 5 to 9 at the University of California, Berkeley. And if you look at isde5.org on the web, you can find it. That's where the scientists are coming together to figure out how to both reverse global warming and deal with poverty and deal with environmental dislocation and all the rest of this. And it's also going to have a pretty intensive portal being put up for people to coordinate so scientists can work with communities. And generally, we're going to have a lot of a systematic intervention throughout the planet.
Well, what about the use of cyberspace or the web in this context, Mark Miller? I mean, does that make sense?
Yeah, I don't have a lot of expertise in that area, so I think I'll defer to the to Michael Kolker or to Kathleen on that.
Well, what do you think, Michael Kolker?
Well, I think so many people that we work with don't have electricity.
Yeah.
You know, the internet is just not a sort of, we're talking about clean water, sanitation, food. But I do think, obviously, when it's a possibility, there's a great deal that can be done through the internet, obviously. We see microcredit programs, for example, direct lending, now beginning to happen, internet-based. So a lot of good trends. But I think
we still have such a great digital divide, though. I mean,
well, there's a tremendous digital divide, and I think that that's why, obviously, you know, it's very, very difficult to talk about the internet to assist refugees and the displaced, certainly in the 25, 30 countries where we work around the world.
Yeah. Yeah. On the other hand,
this is Kathleen Newland.
Yeah, I think there is grounds for optimism. We were talking earlier about the brain drain, but one of the sort of the reverse side of that coin is the role that diaspora groups all over the world are playing in relation to the development of their countries of origin. Some of these efforts are internet-based. There's several networks of scientists, of doctors, of technologists. There's one called the South African Network of South Africans Abroad. There's one called ArmenTech, which is a digital network for Armenia. There are lots of these things where people are trying to take advantage of the fact that you don't have, that immigrants don't have to physically return to their countries of origin in order to make a contribution. The old pattern of earn, learn, return is still a very powerful factor under the right circumstances, but it's not the only pattern. People can also go home for brief visits or teach via video links in a university in their country of their home country, or act as mentors to new businesses that are trying to get started in their country. Mexico has a very strong program for business mentors in the United States to work with startup businesses in Mexico. So I think there is a huge amount of potential here, and particularly perhaps with some of these, the newer technologies that will address problems like those associated with climate change. It's not a panacea by any means, but it is a nice sort of benefit from immigration that is one of the things that's putting traditional concepts of the brain drain in question.
And let me thank our last caller and remind you that in the time remaining, if you'd like to join us, our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, or you can send an email to forum@kqed.org. And Nick, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. And
sure.
I really wanted to comment on, you know, how incredibly to the point both your guests are, and particularly some of the points that Kathleen made. I'm a citizen of three countries. I recently became an American, and I lived in Canada, and I was born in Greece. And I experienced through my transitions, the different ways that Canadians and Americans treat immigrants. And one thing that stood out for me was how different Canadians are in their approach to immigrants, how they treat them with the sense that they do have an original identity and they don't need to compromise that in order to integrate into Canadian society. Whereas here in the U.S., it seemed to me that most of the time you were expected to be an American first, and then after that American label, you could put anything else you wanted, you know, and nobody really cared that much. So that is one thing that I observed. I also wanted to make a point that for me, it was mostly economic and educational reasons that made me immigrate. And I believe that to a large extent, most people immigrate based on economic reasons. If they can't survive and thrive economically in whatever country they choose to immigrate to, they will eventually go back. But I'm noticing that there's another pattern here among the many colleagues and friends that I have, is that many choose to move back to their original countries because they can achieve economic success there, but they can also reap some other benefits, like, you know, a better healthcare system or a better Medicare system, or, you know, in their retirement years and so on and so forth. So I'm wondering what your guests have to say about, you know, I think Kathleen said something about the different ways that people move back to their countries, and I'm seeing that most people now are moving back not for economic reasons, but maybe to enjoy some of the other benefits that they can't get in this country.
Some observations from you, Kathleen Newman?
Sure. I think that's a really interesting question. And one of the things that we often forget is how many migrants do return to their country of origin. Historically, and maybe Mark Miller will have more detailed information, but the return rates as high as sort of 30% are not at all uncommon. I think that's about the proportion of Italian immigrants who returned to Italy after coming to the United States around the turn of the last century. And even now we see quite high return rates, sometimes for negative reasons. You know, people haven't made it or they just never feel comfortable in the new society. Others for positive reasons, because something has changed in their country and they now see economic possibilities. And some for the reason that our caller just mentioned, that you know, there's a comfort level or there's an availability of benefits that are not available in the sort of more rough and tumble society of the United States. In fact, it's not just immigrants. I mean, we did a study here at the Migration Policy Institute on retirement migration of Americans going to Mexico and Panama. And while many of those were Mexicans, you know, going home because their Social Security payments go a lot farther in Mexico than they do in the United States, but some are also American native-born people going for the same reason. You know, healthcare is cheaper. It's easier to get help. You know, the climate is better than in some parts of the United States. So there are a large variety of reasons for people to return to their country of origin, but the common denominator is that, you know, quite a few people do.
And let me thank Nick for his call, and let's get you on, Alice. Welcome.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to say one of the callers alluded to the fact that initially the guests glossed over the fact that there were different policies for racial groups, and so some racial groups benefited from past immigration policies more than others. I think the guests have completely glossed over the fact that certain classes in America benefit from relatively unrestricted immigration compared to other classes, and that there is not enough honesty about this issue at all among people like the guests and others who deal with immigration. To be somewhat specific, my own experience, which was that I was highly educated.
Are you calling us from underneath a foghorn? I don't know.
I'm sorry. Is my voice not clear?
No. There's a strange noise coming through your phone. I don't know what it is.
Oh, could be my router, computer, or
Well, let me go to the class issue, though, because I'm glad you raised it, and I want to hear, Mark Miller, what you have to say about that dirty little secret of America, as we often see it phrased.
Well, I think the caller is right that the benefits and costs of migration are unevenly distributed, and we need to talk about this as a country. I concur totally. I think it's fair to observe that certain employers benefit a great, great deal from exploitation of illegal workers, for example. We all need to be very, very concerned about that. This is controversial, but there's reason to believe that certain groups within American society bear the cost of migration, particularly poor people, people in the lower one-third of the kind of job ladder. So, yeah, we need to be very, very concerned, and there is a need for a very transparent and open discussion of all effects of immigration upon our society. And it's not uniquely something positive. I think, on the whole, the overall historical effect of migration is positive. But there's no doubt in my mind that some benefit more than others, and some are negatively affected by migration.
Well, on that note, I want to just add one email from a listener. It says, surely the key to weaving together a hugely diverse immigrant population in the modern U.S. is education. It wasn't long ago that a penniless immigrant child could receive a kindergarten through PhD program education first class without paying a penny for it. Institutions like CCNY were stocked with Nobel winners. Public elementary and high schools taught real subjects like math and science and English rather than watered-down pap now in vogue. We need to fix the education system, present and future, for the waves of immigrants. And I want to thank our listeners for being with us. Also thank our guest, Mark Miller, who is Emma Smith Morris Professor of Political Science and International Relations at University of Delaware and co-author of The Age of Migration, Michael Coker, Deputy Vice President of International Rescue Committee, and Kathleen Newland, Director of Migration and Development and Refugee Protection with the Migration Policy Institute. And a reminder, you can go to Forum's Immigration Discussion Board on rewriting the U.S. citizenship test at www.kqed.org/immigration. Thanks to our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory, our interns, Lila Rizaki, Christina Shaheen, Claire Liu, and Katie Stanford. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.